This episode is brought to you in part by the Table Podcast from the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm Daryl Bach, one of the hosts, and I invite you to join us as we discuss issues of God and culture, which includes anything and everything. Listen on your podcast app or at dts.edu/thetable.
Hi, welcome to the Finding Holy podcast. I'm your host, Ashley Hales. I'm author of the book Finding Holy in the Suburbs and the forthcoming book called A Spacious Life. Here at the Finding Holy podcast, it is our aim to help you connect the dots to the big things that matter to your everyday holy life. You'll get to hear my guests' laundry routines too, because big things matter, but so does the laundry. Here's a little bit more about my guest today. Todd Wilson is the president and co-founder of the Center for Pastor Theologians and the former senior pastor of Calvary Memorial Church in Oak Park, Illinois. He's the author of Mere Sexuality, Real Christian, and Galatians, Gospel Rooted Living, as well as a co-author of The Pastor Theologian. Today, we talk about his most recent book called The Enneagram Goes to Church. This episode is a part of a several episode series where we're talking about how has the pandemic changed relationships. In this conversation with Todd Wilson, we'll talk not only about the Enneagram, but what does the pandemic do to relationships between people and specifically to those in the church. Listen in for some great wisdom and be sure to tune in to the following episodes as we consider marriage, parenting, and even our relationships with doubt and ourselves. All right, friends, I am excited to welcome to the podcast Todd Wilson. He is the author of the recent book, The Enneagram Goes to Church, Wisdom for Leadership, Worship, and Congregational Life. So thanks for being here, Todd.
Ashley, thanks for having me. It's a privilege and honor to be on the podcast today.
You're so welcome. Well, I think actually it's kind of surprising. I think this is my first Enneagram episode, which is surprising. And also when I was reading your book, I was like, you're an 8 and your wife's a 4. And that's the same pairing as my husband and I. So,
oh, is that right? Yeah. You're the 4 or are you the 8?
I'm the 4. He's the 8.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, they say that's the most intense combination.
Most volatile.
You may have heard that.
Yeah, I have.
I see. I said intense, not volatile.
I read to where it was volatile. I was like, I can resonate with that.
Yeah. I was going to say, we know a little bit about volatility.
Yeah. It's great. Anyway, but like, yeah, it's an intense, interesting combination. So
yes,
I would love it. Maybe if you could just give our listeners, if they've heard of the Enneagram or if they haven't, if you could just give us a quick little overview so everyone's on the same page. Maybe some people who've heard the word Enneagram or seen the memes just kind of feel like it's one of those personality profiles and it's just kind of so overdone and cliche, or like people think it's like voodoo mysticism or something. So could you give us just a little brief overview for the Enneagram skeptic?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, the basic overview is you use the phrase personality typing system. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is a personality typology or typing system, helping us understand that there are different personalities in the world. Mm-hmm. And the Enneagram sees there to be 9 different ways of navigating your way through the world, 9 different personality types. And really it's framed around or organized around how you put together thinking, feeling, and doing. That's why there are 9 different personality types in Enneagram and the Enneagram system. So it's for my, you know, I've been a big fan of personality typing systems for a long while, and have taken tons of the StrengthsFinder and DISC profile and all these different sorts of tests. But for my money, the Enneagram is the best of all of them because it is the most accessible and yet at the same time, the most profound. So it's, you can pick it up very quickly. Which is great. It's not overly complicated in that sense. And yet at the same time, once you get into it, it's like a pool that kind of goes into the deep end, right? Mm-hmm. You can wade in the baby pool side of it. And then keep getting into it, it just gets deeper and deeper and deeper and more profound. That's what it is. 9 personality types, 9 ways of seeing the world, 9 ways of engaging the world, navigating your way through the world, organized around thinking, feeling, and doing.
And you do such a great job, I think, in your book too, talking about how those triads work and how, you know, different numbers, right, have different kind of repressed centers. And so how does that matter for your leadership? How does it matter for your church? How does it matter for your church tradition? And I think it's going to be a really helpful book for leadership, for pastors to think about all of these kind of structural organizational leadership questions, but in terms of the Enneagram. One thing, though, that I loved how you said in the very beginning of your book, you said, if I had known the Enneagram, I would have been a better pastor. Like if I'd known it sooner, I would have been a better pastor. And then you also talk about Jonathan Edwards later in the book about if he had known the Enneagram, maybe he wouldn't have gotten kicked out of his pastorate. So I'd love to hear maybe from yourself or, you know, Edwards or any of these kind of great theologians, how can the Enneagram help us be better leaders and to love our people better?
Yeah, great. Thanks for that. Yeah, I was on a walk with my wife and, we did that regularly. And the thought occurred to me, man, I wish I would have known the Enneagram because it's been so helpful. And I didn't discover the Enneagram until I was a number of years into the pastor where I was at, the senior pastor for 10 years. And actually, once I learned about the Enneagram, but frankly, more importantly, once I learned about me and other people, it did a number of things. I mean, it just helped me see my blind spots. Mm-hmm. And the way I work in the world, the way I approach pastoral leadership, the way I approach preaching, the way I approach team meetings, the way I approach everything, of course, is a function of my personality, which has its gold and it also has its shadow, just like all of our personalities do. We've got our strengths and our weaknesses and our personalities. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you're not sensitive to that, I think we're all tempted to make our personality normative for other people.
Right.
Like, why don't other people engage the world the way I do? Like, and in a Christian setting, I think we're tempted to then not just make normative our personality, but then moralize the differences.
Right. Yeah.
What's wrong with that person that they're not more this or more that, you know, and we start to make value judgments. And I must confess, I mean, I did that as a pastor. And pastoring is such a people business, right? And church life and ministry is so people intensive. And the Enneagram just really is a marvelous like compass to help you navigate all of that. Mm-hmm. I could go on for a long time on the ways in which it helped my ministry and give you lots of examples.
Yeah. Well, like walk us through.
Where I look back and I feel grieved in some respects. Mm. I just think about, like, let me give you one simple example. I think about as an 8 in the Enneagram. So that's an aggressive type. That's an assertive type. You're future oriented. Your vision and forward movement and all of this comes very naturally to you as an 8 in the Enneagram, which is a great strength in leadership and pastoral leadership. Mm-hmm. But I think about, you know, congregational meetings we had. And we had many congregational meetings at my church. And I think about more challenging things in our congregational meetings was the Q&A time, right? Congregational meetings, you have these question and answer time.
Right.
And many personality types would step up to the microphone and ask questions, wanting to find out, you know, things about this, that, or the other thing. But if you're an 8, you're tempted to take this as pushback.
Right.
And as challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just such a simple example, but I think about how many times I took it personally, people's honest, genuine questions as a challenge to my leadership and direction, flowing out of insecurity and just kind of misreading the situation. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I would understand the Enneagram, I could have said something to myself like, this is probably a 6 in the Enneagram asking me a genuine question, not challenging my leadership at all or the church's leadership at all, but just really curious and wants to sort of shore up their own anxieties. That's why they're asking the question. Just that's a simple thing, but that would help me so much. I could apply that to a million different situations in leadership that I faced over the years.
So it allows you to be kind of a differentiated leader, right? Too.
That's exactly like,
it's
right.
It's helping you not take on everybody's anxieties.
That's right.
Or at least to know that their anxieties are their anxieties and they don't necessarily... Right. have to be directly related to your own leadership and authority.
Yeah, and I love that differentiated, it helps you be a differentiated leader, but it helps you in the process and journey of differentiation as an individual. And then reading other people's way of being in the world or being at church or interacting with you or interacting with your congregation, whatever, with much more compassion and generosity, where you're not moralizing your personality differences, you're compassionately and sympathetically, you know, just saying, hey, we see the world very differently and it impacts a lot.
I'm thinking, you know, as you're talking a little bit about the ways in which we have lacked compassion. We lack dialogue most of the time, like on social media, because you don't have an embodied presence. How can the Enneagram help us? I mean, if you're probably not going on Twitter to like everyone's profile and be like, what Enneagram number are they writing in their profile before I respond to this? Can some of this at least help us, you know, personally, even as we engage in conversation on social media as well, besides just like our local embodied communities?
What a great question. I don't know that I thought that through. Do you have ideas on that? That's a great question.
Well, I mean, it's got to at least be self-awareness.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you can't necessarily, like, you know that person asking the question at the microphone in the Q&A.
Yeah.
And you can be like, oh, they're probably a six, or I can
kind
of tell they're probably at least in this triad. And I know that person, I know their fears. And so I can temper myself because I know that person. Online, it's just like a big expanse, right? So,
yes.
I mean, but at least we can think about ourselves. So I wonder, know, self-knowledge, how that might be helpful in an online
No, that's great. I mean, I think social media, I mean, it does seem to be a nice place for people to vent anxiety, fear, and anger.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one of the interesting things about the Enneagram is talking about these underlying triggers, shame, fear, and anger in the different triads. Mm-hmm. And I suspect they're, you know, I mean, you really got me thinking now about, but I suspect, you know, we all would be helped by being very aware of, are we primarily triggered by shame, fear, or anger? And then how are we tempted to kind of let that out in social media channels, right? If you're a 2, 3, 4, you're in the feeling heart triad, shame is a trigger for you, or a driver, you might say. Mm-hmm. There'd be lots of ways in which that might manifest itself on social media. An 8, 9, 1, you're in the body or gut triad, and anger is a driver and a trigger. And, you know, so it'd be kind of how we're tempted to engage and indulge in those, that shadow side of our personality. Mm-hmm. And social media, I think, makes that easy to do precisely because it's not embodied.
Yeah. How can our church communities, and maybe how can leaders in the church then, if that's where all the people are coming from, you know, and especially after, as we're beginning, we hope to emerge from this global pandemic where we've been kind of apart and isolated, how do you think church leaders can engage that actual reality of that isolation, of the shame, of the fear, of the anger, to help people again become whole?
Another great, I mean, that's a great, these are great questions.
And, I like and asking I'm, questions.
I was going to say, I'm staring off, my brain is just buzzing, thinking through. That's such a good question. I always feel like as a pastor, as a parent, as a pastor, as someone who works, you know, works with people, that naming it, just naming the reality is at least 50% of the battle.
Yeah.
You know how this goes with parenting, right? I mean, it's just naming the issue, the proverbial elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. And so I think pastors welcoming people back into in-person congregational worship in light of the last year, and not just COVID shutdown and isolation, but then all of the other issues that have gone on, a national election that was very stirring for, I think, the vast majority of the country. You know, and stirring is about as euphemistic as I can make it, right? I mean, you know, and then racial justice issues, so significant, that are live time right now in Minnesota. And, you know, I think for pastors to courageously and compassionately name those realities and invite, and one of the things I found as a pastor in wading into delicate issues like this is just the relief that congregants can feel when the pastor takes the first step and names some reality and like models the way to broach a topic and engage in a topic. I remember, I hope this isn't too much information for your podcast, but I remember several years into my pastoral ministry, found myself in a therapist's office. Well, I was given a 3-month sabbatical and started to unravel because I found out I was addicted to achievement, just like a good eight. And next thing you know, I'm in a therapist's office trying to figure out what on earth is going on inside of me that's just gone bonkers with this 3-month sabbatical where I'm supposed to relax. And I realized I have no emotional capacity to relax, actually.
Yeah.
And I remember sharing with the congregation after I got back from my sabbatical about this. mm-hmm. very candidly. And the sense of relief, you could almost, it was palpable in the congregation, as because of course so many congregants struggle, not exactly like I do, but in other kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. And for the pastor to model this and name these kinds of realities gives mm-hmm. permission to the congregation. And it was mm-hmm. and I just had a number of people. So anyways, that's a long-winded way of saying if pastors will take the lead to name mm-hmm. the difficult issues and wade into these conversations and create space for people to, you know, turn to their neighbor in the pew next to them, so to speak, mm-hmm. and dialogue openly and candidly. I think that goes a long way to just helping us get ourselves back into a better place.
I think that's a great first step.
This episode is brought to you in part by Beyond Ordinary Women Ministries, which prepares Christian women for leadership. At BOW, we believe that every woman is a leader because she influences someone. So, whom do you influence? Do you mentor a woman, serve in the workplace, or do you lead a small group, teach the Bible, or even lead an entire ministry? No matter who or how many you influence, our free online resources will help equip you. Our videos, podcast episodes, and articles from experienced women leaders will encourage you and perfect your leadership skills. They offer wisdom for dealing with ministry pitfalls, current biblical issues, health for your own soul, and insights for shepherding others well. In addition, BOW offers Bible studies designed to connect women of multiple generations. They provide a challenge to both women new to the Bible and those wanting to dig deeper. Be our guest and browse all of our free resources and low-cost Bible studies at beyondordinarywomen.org.
One thing you do also talk about that I really appreciated when you talk about this idea of self-awareness is you talk about it, this phrase that self-awareness for the sake of others. And I was like, yes, that's so good. Because I, you know, most of the time I think things that are peddled are either just like, you know, outside of a Christian space, it's like, look inside yourself because really you are the arbiter of the good life, you know? And so it's all up to you and your individualism. Or even in Christian circles, we have this idea, like this kind of navel gazing that can be unhealthy too. Talk us through this idea about how the Enneagram can help us be self-aware, but also for the sake of others, this combination of self and others.
Yeah, great, great question. I mean, the Enneagram just specializes in helping you become self-aware, right? I mean, it helps point the light on your personality and your operating system, right? Mm-hmm. And most of us go through life just utilizing the operating system without pausing of our personality, without pausing to be more self-reflective about it and develop mind, what Dan Siegel, the psychiatrist, calls mindsight, the ability to look inside yourself and see what's going on. So the Enneagram's great in that, but putting it within a Christian frame, I mean, that really needs to be in the service of loving other people, or the way Jesus would put it, denying yourself, taking up your cross and following after Christ, just as Christ did, laying down your life for the sake of other people. The idea, this, that way of putting it really came to me, Ashley, again, from a counseling session I was doing with the coach therapist that I still meet with today. It was a number of years ago. And my wife and I were wrestling with a very significant decision that we were going to make that was going to involve some sacrifice on our part to love someone else. And I was really wrestling with it. And I had a lot of hesitation about it. And I was unpacking it with my kind of therapist coach. And I said, his name is Jack. And I said, Jack, I just feel selfish about not going through with doing this. And he said, Todd, you need to first have a self before you can be selfish. Which was a profound and counterintuitive thing to say. But like, you need to have it, you used the language of differentiation. You need to have a differentiated self. You need to know yourself before you can, you know, before you can give yourself away. So that's, I think, the was a real turning point for me in thinking about the relationship between self-awareness and self-sacrifice or giving yourself away. Because as you know, we can do things for the sake of others that really aren't flowing from giving ourself away, but are feeding our ego in certain kinds of ways. Even though it looks sacrificial, it may not actually in substance be very sacrificial because you're doing it to stroke yourself or get something out of it, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. So what does that process look like practically? How can people start to become self-aware for the sake of others? Or, you know, is it like seasonal where, you know, maybe it's this period where I'm pulling away from community or from others to dive into the Enneagram or, you know, what is, or what does that look like for you? Some folks that you've kind of worked through the Enneagram with.
You know, the Enneagram talks about, as we talk about thinking, feeling, and doing, mm-hmm. and you lead with one and we all repress another one, either thinking, feeling, or doing. Mm-hmm. And I think if you find, you know, if you look into your own heart and mind and personality and see how you work in the world, I think we'll find that, you know, perhaps our greatest opportunity to sacrificially love other people is by leaning into that part of our personality we repress. So, for example, I'm an 8, which means I lead with doing, I back it up with thinking, and I drop feeling. Or relationships, right? So the feeling triad, relational triad, I drop feeling. So it's very easy for me to make things happen in the world, to strategize, to push things forward. I have a ton of plates always spinning in my life. I love all this. It's very difficult for me to slow down, be sensitive to the feelings of others, be even sometimes aware of others, right?
Yeah. I remember Suzanne. Yeah,
you know, yes, you right, Mary doing it. Yeah. I remember Suzanne Stabile, who I've dedicated the book to, and we did a year-long cohort, my wife and I, with her. And I remember her saying, Ashley, early on, she remember her saying, you know, 8s can be socially awkward, and I took great offense at that. I'm like, wait, I'm a very savvy person. What is she talking about?
Yeah.
I asked my wife about it, and who's a 4 like you, she was like, yeah, you know, Todd, it's not that you're like clunky. It's that you are so doing, thinking oriented and relationally and emotionally drops out for you that you can just be unaware of.
Right. Yeah.
These relational dynamics and other people. So actually, that's just a way of saying, as I've grown in self-awareness about that, and it's been hard, it's been painful to have to say that about myself. Like, yeah, I can be socially awkward, which is a way of saying I can just step into a room and just be too much.
Yeah. Right.
Just be too much in a way that will not be sensitive to other people, in a way that will not be attentive and attuned to the relational dynamics in the room, in a way that will be totally unintentionally, but just domineering, just take over.
Yeah.
So all that's to say, I can give myself away. I can love others sacrificially by raising that part of my personality, that repressed part of my personality. Mm-hmm. And that's a ton of hard work for an 8.
Yeah. No, I'm internalizing all this stuff because my repressed is doing. And I often even just say, well, it's so good for me even just to like go out for a walk and to be outside because I'd much rather just sit and read or, you know, do nothing. But
that's right.
Keep all the thinking and the feeling going, you know? So,
yeah. And I would imagine for a 4, being married to a 4, that, you know, I would imagine you did you like, I would imagine
hypothetically,
It is sacrificial love in following after Jesus when a 4 raises the doing repressed center and does the practical, mundane, tedious things of life that make 4s crazy. Because there's no magic and mystery and romance to like balancing the checkbook, so to speak, right?
Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
So the stances in the Enneagram are so helpful. That is to say, what part of your personality you repress, thinking, feeling, or doing? Mm-hmm. And the question then that I often encourage people to ask is depends upon their stance, which is like if you're a feeling repressed, the question to ask yourself is, what do I feel about this in any given situation or decision you're facing? Or what do I feel about this? My wife now asks me that regularly. Todd, what do you feel? And oftentimes I have to say, I have no idea what I feel, but that's the leading edge of my growth is right there. Mm-hmm. And as I lean into that and I'm able to like get more acquainted with what I feel and how I relate relationally with other people, I will grow in Christ likeness, I think. Mm-hmm. And the same with people that suppress thinking.
Right.
Sixes, ones, and twos. The question for them is, what do I think about this? What do I think about this? And as I think they raise that repressed center, they will be living more into the fullness of Christ, it seems to me. And then same with those that repress doing, the four, as we've been talking about, and the five and the nine as well.
What do I do about
this? What do I do about this? What do I do about this? Or what is mine to do in this?
What's your hope, because, I think, you know, for the church in kind of pairing the Enneagram with the church, helping pastors become much more self-aware about how they're preaching, even, you know, you talk about kind of Enneagram in our church traditions.
Yes.
You're an eight. So what's your like big 50,000 foot hope and dream and like goal as we have these conversations?
Yes, a more integrated church. Filled with more integrated people and led by more integrated pastors who are not just spiritually formed, but psychologically healthy.
That's good.
I love the Enneagram as a means to get after the bigger concept for me, which is integration.
Yeah.
Becoming integrated people. So the thing about Christians is, and pastors and Christian leaders, is they can be both godly and dysfunctional at the same time.
Yep.
And this is scary stuff, you know, right? I mean, you can have a godly pastor who loves Jesus, loves the Bible, loves the mission, all the rest of it, and is pretty dysfunctional psychologically. And by the way, we see the tragic news of these stories just about every week, where these amazing pastors or Christian leaders actually, on closer examination, have some serious issues that they have been carrying around for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And that lack of integration and wholeness has finally caught up with them.
Yeah.
Perhaps through the pressures of their work and their role. So that is my passion, Ashley, is to see the church be not just spiritually formed, but psychologically whole. Christians to be both godly and well-adjusted psychologically, right?
Yeah.
Because I found it so helpful in my own life and other people that I care about who have been on this journey. It enables you, empowers you to better love like Christ loved and look with compassion on other people and engage sympathetically and patiently with broken people. And, you know, so on. I could go on and on, but that's the 50,000 foot vision and passion.
I love it. I think that's a beautiful vision and one that we can all get behind to, you know, do the hard work of self-awareness for the sake of others. So Todd, as we conclude our conversation, I always love to ask my guests about their laundry routines, primarily probably because I'm a four and I don't like doing. And so it helps make meaning out of the mundane. And
there it is.
Yeah, that's probably where it comes from. I'm a fan of Kathleen Norris and her quotidian mysteries. So,
yes.
But now, see, it's all back to the Enneagram. But I'd love to hear your laundry routine. And you have a pile of children, so I'm assuming
We do have a pile of children. So to my wife's credit, she trained, we have seven children, and so she trained all of them in how to do their laundry. So honestly, they have all been doing their laundry for years. Our youngest, we have a 20-year-old down to twins, sixth graders, 12-year-olds.
Okay.
They all do their laundry. So it's really hilarious. Like I'll be sitting downstairs in the morning, having my cup of coffee, whatever. And one of my sixth grade boys will come flying down the stairs and, you know, be throwing stuff in the dryer that he put in the washer the night before because he's got to, you know, get his jeans all tidied up to put on to go to school.
Yes.
So all this to say, our laundry routine is we cheer our children on because they do their own laundry. Now, the challenge has been, where do we put the laundry when we pull it out of the dryer when they pull it out of the dryer, right? Because it's seven, you know, nine people in our house and there's clothes sometimes everywhere. So that's been one of the challenges. In fact, right now on the landing going up to the upstairs bedrooms, there's piles of clothes in there that need to be gathered up. So
yes. So, but do you do your own then?
I do not do my own laundry.
Do your wife?
No. My wife does
she's like the laundry goddess, apparently.
She is the laundering goddess, right? So, but she only manages my laundry and her laundry.
Right.
All the rest of the kids
and just make sure the kids are whipped
into
shape.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Todd. It's been really very fun to have you, and thank you for your book.
Great to be on. Yeah, thank you, Ashley. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Friends, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Todd Wilson. It was so fun, and it was really fun to have the connection with Enneagram type. If the Enneagram is something that's new to you, his book is a great primer, and there's also a few other books that University Press has published on the Enneagram, including Suzanne Stabile's The Road Back to You. That's a great start. And IVP has also released 40-day devotionals on each Enneagram type. I'm definitely planning to get their Enneagram 4 devotional, but that might be a great gift for yourself or for a friend. I want to leave you, friends, with one small step as you take all of these great thoughts and ideas into your practical, everyday, holy life. And Todd reminds us that the greatest opportunity we have to love others sacrificially is by leaning into that part of our personality that we've suppressed, whether that's doing, thinking, or feeling. So if, for instance, your doing center is repressed, the question you might want to ask yourself is, what is mine to do? If your feeling center is repressed, which means you do or act from your gut and you think more, you might want to lean into, how can I hear and listen to someone else's feelings? And even ask yourself, what do I feel in this moment? If your thinking center is repressed, so you tend to either feel or do, you might begin to ask yourself, what do I think in this situation? And as we navigate challenges in the church and in communities and our neighborhoods, this might be just one small step that you can take with you into your everyday holy life to begin to live not just for ourselves, but for the good of the world. Lastly, friends, I have some good news for you. Make sure you're tuning in to this small series week after week as we consider what has the pandemic done to our relationships. We talked today about the Enneagram and the church and even our relationship with ourselves. But we'll talk more about parenting and marriage and technology, as well as our relationship with ourselves and the issues of doubt. So join me for that. And I have some good news too, is that I want to give you a copy of Todd's book and other friends' books as we go through this series together. All you need to do during this 5-week series is to go to iTunes right now, leave a review of the Finding Holy podcast. Make sure you let me know on social media. You can tag me at AA Hales or use the hashtag Finding Holy podcast. I'll be sure to find it. And at the end of our series, I'm going to give away a whole stack of books. So I can't wait. Make sure you leave a review. It helps connect the dots for new listeners to find the Finding Holy podcast as we help them connect dots between things that matter and your everyday holy life. So share it with a friend and leave your review, because big things matter, but so does the laundry.